You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Vasiliki Antonopoulou. Vasiliki, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for inviting me. Thank you.
So you're talking to us from London. I guess let's begin with that. I want to talk about your background, of course, but I'd love to hear a snapshot of what you're working on at the moment in your studio.
Sure. So I just started working on a new video, actually. It's a work that imagines a future where glass has taken over our landscape. My work generally focuses on ideas of displacement and our emotional relationships with particular spaces. So for this project, I'm using existing locations to speculate space in the future. So as a way of kind of imagining what's coming next, and the increasing use of glass in the development of major cities, in London specifically, which is where I'm based, is what triggered this work. So there's this push toward a uniform urban identity, and it makes me wonder how a queer body will be able to exist in this kind of increasingly hypernormative and conservative environment. So yeah, I'm working on a video that is kind of looking at this at the moment.
So that's very interesting. So just to go over that before we go into more, I mean, talking about how a queer body would fit into this landscape, but also talking about the landscape, I mean, this video will be about the landscape in terms of, did you mean literally? It's in terms of glass, because as a social phenomenon, architectural phenomenon, I know you also have a degree in architecture as well as fine art. It seems that this idea of more and more glass, is interpreted as a type of meaning of modernism, right? And just clarify me if I'm not understanding, but that kind of the more glass we have, and as you're describing it, also points to how does a queer body, meaning a person, navigate this kind of system that, as you're saying, is sort of hyper-normative or something? Like it's kind of forced, it's becoming more and more conservative. Is that what you mean by glass?
Exactly. Before I go on, to not take credit where it's not deserved, I've got a foundation in architecture. I skipped the 7-year process, so I've got a lot of influence, but not the full degree. But basically, it's exactly what you're saying. I mean, when I use the word queer, I use it in a more broad sense. You know, people usually associate it with like sexuality and things. What I mean is in terms of the other. So any difference, whatever that means for whatever.
So somebody coming in from another country, the other, which is something
exactly,
we hear more
which
about.
Changes so, but depending.
Yeah.
Yeah, which changes depending on where you're from. It's quite fluid, you know, which kind of is basically what's decreasing in this environment that, yeah, architecturally it's both glass becomes both a sort of a metaphor, but also a literal a form of our cities, and it's removing any kind of sort of identity, and everything is becoming the same. And what struck me specifically to this material is, and the way of it's imagining this conservative future, is the act of mark making. If you look at, you know, other materials such as brick, for example, and if you visit, you know, older parts of cities, there's evidence of human existence. Like you see the steps and they're torn down, or there's a scratch, there's some kind of mark. With glass, that disappears. Every day can be wiped clean. So even the kind of teenage gesture of mark making, of writing something as a form of, you know, from existence to then resistance or public expression, it just becomes impossible. So when I talk about hypernormativity, that's kind of what I mean, this sort of forced environment where everything has to be, up to a kind of controlled conservative, as it seems to be going towards that way, environment.
That's very interesting, yeah, because glass also, you know, I think of it as something you look through, but when I think of it in architecture, it's, I mean, the, what comes to mind now is mirrors that you can't see through it.
Yeah. It's an increasing transparency, which, I mean, on one hand, transparency can be both a positive and negative, depends on where you're looking at it. But this kind of urban transparency is not an institutional transparency, for example, something that kind of lets you, gives you insight into the system. It's more transparency into the public. So how do and you look at surveillance, for example, like in, and like you're saying with mirrors, it's just a kind of constant sort of exposure.
Hmm. I want to talk more about your work, and but first I know that it's influenced a lot by your past in Greece and Saudi Arabia. Can you tell me a little bit about your childhood and moving around? And then we'll talk more about your work, because that figures into your work, doesn't it?
No, absolutely. Well, I was born in Greece, and when I was 7 years, we moved to 7 years old. My mother and my siblings, we moved to Saudi Arabia to kind of rejoin with my father and sort of be, you know, together as kind of one family. So I grew up in Saudi Arabia, but the kind of structure of the city, Jeddah is where I grew up, is this difference between the expat and the immigrant. So we were considered expats, and we lived in compounds, which were gated communities. So everything was controlled, and you were sort of driven, you know, from the compound to the school or, you know, a shopping mall or whatever. That was kind of the only thing that existed. So that kind of environment feeds a lot into my work, because, for example, I don't speak Arabic, or I don't even understand it, even though I grew up there, whereas my brother, being male, and, you know, obviously, you know, the situation in Saudi Arabia and the difference that's between male and female bodies there, like, he speaks Arabic. So my experience was very different as a kind of woman, because, yeah, you kind of had zero interaction with the environment. So it could have been anywhere, basically. It just happened to be this compound, just happened to be sort of placed in Saudi Arabia. But the way it was sort of structured, that kind of didn't mean anything. And that's when I started looking at this idea of displacement and kind of parallel existences and seeing spaces, you know, if you strip it down to its kind of physical elements, you know, the dimensions of it, for example, then it can kind of be anything, and you know, depending on everyone's kind of position of, you know, within it.
Well, what do you mean it could be anything? I mean, in your situation, which is very interesting, right, in Saudi Arabia, living in a kind of, if and just correct me if I'm wrong, so you're living in a kind of an expat compound, but
yes,
there is this, you're very much cut off from the other life that's happening there, the cultural life, for a number of reasons, right? Also, you know, for your family to protect you more, or whatever it is, but some kind of wanting to keep. I don't know, why is that walled off? I guess that's a good question. Why the compound, the you know, the distinction and the lack of movement among the society, is that? Would it seem dangerous, or what's the problem there?
Not at all. In fact, it's basically Saudi Arabia, you know, discovered oil, and then suddenly they realized what a power they were. But they needed to import service, so engineers, people like that, to kind of develop the city, because they were, you know, once they discovered this. So the difference between people coming into, you know, you've seen it like in colonial histories, that Saudi Arabia actually, as a country that was, it was inviting people out, and they had the money. So that is the kind of imposed control from the government. They don't want a kind of Western influence in their culture. So that's the reason. It's kind of, there's a lot of rules and regulations that don't allow you to integrate. And if you look at history, it's quite smart. You know, they basically it's very much about them maintaining sort of ownership of knowing, okay, you're a necessary evil, you're coming here, you know, because we need you, but, you know, this is still kind of our place. And, I mean, if you think of it in terms of what, you know, if we look at it in a Western point of view, obviously there's a lot of issues with that. But at the same time, if you look at it in a more broad way, this idea of, you know, not wanting an external influence and having that control is, you wish different, you know, in different histories people had that, you know, if you look at this sort of example. But that was basically it. It was just a matter of
right. You mean different history people might have had that, because it does retain there that you know, everything else aside, that does retain their kind of cultural identity by doing that. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, they kind of have control over their, it doesn't become a kind of, you know, colonial issue where suddenly, you know, the West takes over and changes the whole landscape. It just, unfortunately, in this case, with it being Saudi Arabia, the kind of things they want to maintain are, you know, I mean, generally not the great, like, you know, if you look at women's rights and things like that and certain laws.
Right, but the model of maintaining culture is, of course, interesting. Or societies, would be nice to have seen that in other places, as opposed to them getting completely westernized or colonialized. So with your work, that's quite a childhood, right? You're talking about this, of course, as an adult, and this is making sense to me, but as a child growing up there from age 8 on, you probably had a different perspective that also... I would imagine it informs your work now more. I don't know. Was it like just your own world, or is there always this awareness of being the other? Were you the other there?
Well, it was very interesting. It kind of kept shifting. So the compound was Greek because my family's Greek and it was a kind of Greek company. So in that context, kind of you were the one, you know, because that compound, you know, was kind of a weird utopia where it was suddenly Greece, you know, almost. But then the moment you exited it, you were there, and of course you felt it. But exactly because I was so young when we moved, it's kind of what I thought was normal. And I only, as I started, you know, as I was growing up and different kids were moving from Greece, and they obviously had a different experience. Like suddenly you had, you know, I was, let's say 12, 13, and someone new came in who was a teenager that was suddenly taken from, you know, the freedom of being in Europe into a compound in Saudi Arabia. They were obviously not very happy about it. So that kind of, you know, made me sort of realize that, oh, what am I missing out on? And, you know, realizing that, you know, there's more life really out there. But I was lucky. I was right. Lucky because, like, I managed to get used to it.
So tell me a little bit about, then let's come back to the video you're making now or is about to be shown. Tell me more about the elements of that, because you talked about a landscape of glass, but did you actually mean architecture? How does that play out in the video? Is the video about architecture, or is it something else? I'm trying to visualize it a little bit.
Well, it's a mix of using architecture, so glass buildings, but also talking about glass metaphorically, because I use metaphors a lot in my work. So the kind of the final result is a video work, but I use text. Text is very important in performance. So what I do in kind of the process that I work is I write, and I perform for the camera or in site-specific locations. So then all that sort of comes together, where there is a shift between the sort of the visual, so footage, film footage, acting as a background for the text to literally stay on top, or when text becomes a subtitle and the image becomes more prominent. So the main kind of narrative in this work shifts from, let's say we're now in this future where glass has taken over, and it speaks about that as if it's the present. And then it goes to the past where it sort of tries to, you know, explain, like, as a storytelling of how this happened. So I'm using a kind of more narrative scene of a beach, which is where the metaphor of describing, like, bodies coming together, and with the heat and the friction, then that turns the sand into glass. So in a way, love becomes a trigger for this change, and that's what then happens. And then, you know, because I use love a lot as a metaphor in my work, it becomes the thing that sort of is trying to be repressed, something that's so powerful, which is that's kind of where it, that's the point that's more sort of clear in terms of a narrative.
And so how will the whole thing come together? You'll do how does the performance text and video come together? Will people see them all at once? Will they be at different times? How will this be presented?
So it's all in one video. So I've kind of stepped away from performing live. I mean, I do it. I still do it, but it's not my main practice as it used to be. So I perform either for the camera or inside specific locations without informing anyone. And, you know, anyone, the audience is just people who happen to be there. So the videos are a kind of collage, if you like, of filmed footage, which in this case is architecture. A lot of it has, I've been filming in like Canary Wharf, for example, and in the beach in the summer in Athens. And then that is collaged with like performances, so performance for the camera and the text that's on top of it. So it's kind of those layers make the video. So it's just, usually it's just one projection, some elements maybe, but usually it's just made for a single channel video.
And you've just had some events recently, right? On October 6th and 7th, there was a few things that happened in the first week of this month. Were those also videos that you were showing?
It was a mix. So it was ArtLix weekend, and there were two kind of events. One was a performance for, I was invited by a collective called the Queer Campervan, which is a performance platform. So for that, for instance, I did a reading from the script, which is a text that goes in this video. And that was the performance. And then the other two programs were for this platform called A to Z, and there were screenings. So there I showed the video I just completed for my master's degree.
And this work, a lot of it obviously doesn't seem to be, you know, as they say, in the marketplace, right? And I mean, I know you're just graduating too, but how do you, are you also going to be teaching? Do you imagine it's supported by grants or sales? How does the work support itself?
Well, finding a teacher job is kind of the dream. It's quite difficult so far to find that. I mean, I was invited to do tutorials and crits at the AA where I did my foundation. I've been doing that sometimes, but it's not a kind of regular. And unfortunately, as you know, it's an increasing problem where no one pays artists. And I try to kind of, as a way, you know, not do things for free, but it's quite difficult. I mean, that's a whole conversation, really. We can talk hours about this. So I'm just doing separate, like, jobs outside, like, random jobs to try and maintain my practice. Yeah.
And this is the beginning of it, right? Because you've just been through a lot of schooling. You've been in school since, for almost the last eight years, right?
Exactly, almost nonstop. So I just kind of, this summer I graduated from the RCA, so now is kind of the first time that I've, you know, I'm kind of officially, you know, I mean, maybe I'll do more education later on, but, you know, it's not in the near future. So now is kind of the beginning, really.
Well, is there more support in London for filmmaking and artistic practice? I mean, I was interviewing an artist the other day who said in Berlin, it was easy to get funding for films, or fairly easy, as opposed to, I mean, for him then it was the United States. But, you know, in London, is there a supportive arts council? Is that something that you can expect support from or thinking of?
There are some, you know, kind of things that you can apply to, like grants that you can apply to. It's just that, unfortunately, they're not many and they're not enough to support the amount of artists and people working here. And of course there's the Arts Council as well, but, you know, the kind of, they all have quite complicated application process. Of course it's there, but it's not enough, not as much as there should be.
Well, it's wonderful talking with you, Vasiliki. I wanted to ask you the last question. What are you reading at the moment? I'm always curious what everyone's reading.
Well, I just started reading Sarah Ahmed's Queer Phenomenology, which is actually, I was recommended to it by a friend of mine, artist Rebecca Jago. Yeah, so that's what I'm reading at the moment, what I've just started. Yep.
And what's the name of that book? That's it's Queer Phenomenology?
Yes, by Sarah Ahmed.
Very good. It's interesting because, you know, so that's also, I mean, as you said during the interview, of course, what's informing your work, queer studies or the idea of orientation and how we're looking at things, right? That's a
exactly.
Big part of, and we didn't talk about that in your childhood and everything else, but that makes sense culturally as well, that's a big part of your work.
Absolutely, which is, I mean, yeah, this idea of orientation is very important.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you. I want to thank you so much for spending time with me today, and I wish you the best with your work.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the invitation. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.